Hello, Zifeng. Welcome to
Hello.
the podcast. Thank you so much for being here with us today. And thank you so much for joining the podcast and sharing your experience and research with us on China studies, Africana studies, and feminism studies. We're very grateful. And our audience don't know you yet, so I'm just gonna quickly go over. Well, you and I are really good friends, going way back when we were, when I was at Columbia. You're right now a final year candidate, PhD candidate in Africana studies at Cornell, and you study Black transnationalism, internationalism, and Black feminism and anti-colonial thought, and correct me if I'm wrong. Is your dissertation, which is coming up next year, I guess you're gonna finish, is it still the Redrawing the Balance of Power, Black Left Feminist, Mao's China, and the Making of an Afro-Asian Political Imaginary?
Yeah, that's still my dissertation project.
That sounds really cool.
Thank
And
you.
on the I'm reading your bio now on the website at Cornell, and you're examining the feminist interchanges and collaborations between the African American freedom struggle and the Chinese socialist construction of modernity from 1949 through 1978. And you are really well published in all sorts of academic journals and also in a lot of Chinese state media, and including Sina News, including Bloomberg News in China. And we're really happy that you're here. And as we know, this month is Women's Month, or what do you call? Well,
Women's History Month in the US.
History Month, yes, in US, should be in the world, I think. In 2 days is, of course, San Ba Fu Ni Jie, is Women's Day. So we'd love to hear more about your studies. Can you tell us a little bit more about your research topics, and particularly, like, why did you get interested in this? And I think a lot of people are really new to either topic, like Black feminism and like China socialist, and these are big words. So can you tell us a little bit more?
Sure. Yes. So thank you so much for having me here. And it's always a pleasure to be in conversation with you. And the I guess bio on the website of my department, Africana Studies and Research Center at Cornell, it's meant to be a kind of a, promotional thing, right? I mean, that is, something that I need to have when I need a job in American academia. So yeah, so it's definitely a kind of promotional kind of, it has a, I guess, a sense of a kind of self-promotion, self-elevation in it. So just don't really take that introduction too seriously. And yeah, so I study Africana studies. So my program, it's Africana Studies. So Africana Studies is not African studies, because African studies, still has its roots in Western colonialism, right? So when all those Western empires had positions in Africa, Asia, the Caribbean, the Americas. So, I mean, in the case of African studies in Africa, so they wanted to be able to study the cultures, languages, and peoples in Africa so as to be able to better manage their colonies, right? So, African studies at its really roots really is a colonial project, right? And we can still say it is still a colonial project. African studies as a field, it's still grappling with the its really kind of entanglement with colonialism. Whereas Africana studies grew out of the student movements in the US in the 1960s, right? So African-American students wanted to have a program devoted to their culture, their history, their lives, right? And but African-American studies or Africana studies was not just, I mean, when it was created, it was not just about Black people in America, right? So Black people in America, when they founded that, you know, program, they also wanted to study Black people globally, right? So that's why we use Africana to talk about like this kind of emphasis on global Blackness, right? How Blackness is manifested globally, is understood globally, right? Mm-hmm. So that's what Africana studies is. And for me, I see myself as a historian, even though I'm not in the field of history, but I am a historian in Africana studies. Mm-hmm. I study African-American history, more precisely 20th century African-American freedom struggle that includes what we know as the Civil Rights Movement, and later the Black Power Movement. And my dissertation, which is supposed to be the kind of new knowledge that I am producing, that I am adding to, the scholarship on the African-American freedom struggle, is about Black left feminism and China.
And China,
right? You being Chinese. Yeah, I'm trying to understand, you know, how Black feminists wrote about China, how they engaged China, right? Mm-hmm. And how that engagement could tell us about Black feminism in general, about China in the global 60s, and about Black radicalism in general, right? So that's something that I'm trying to explore, and I'm still doing it.
That's really cool. I think that it's probably safe to say that people in your position who are in academia, who knows both China, Chinese academic research very well, and African-American studies, Africana studies really well, are very few. And particularly you being from China, growing up in China, it's a rare combination. Are there more scholars like you, you would say, like, or mostly are the scholars studying in the field mostly Americans, or are they mostly like people of African heritage, maybe?
Definitely it's natural that Black people want to study the history, cultures, ideas produced by Black people, right? But Africana studies is not just really a field that can only be studied by Black scholars, right? And and the fact is that in Africana studies, they are scholars. They are white scholars, they are Asian scholars. There are not many people like me who was raised and born in China, but still Africana studies as a field, it offers a range of frameworks and ideas for us to understand, modernity, for us to understand capitalism, for us to understand race and how race intersects with gender, sexuality, class, nation, ability, and all other systems of oppression or categories of identification. So I study Africana studies because I am deeply interested in learning about how Black people devised ideas and frameworks to confront various systems of oppression, right? And how we can understand the history of the modern world. And if we want to know really like how the world in which we live, right, the world we inhabit came into being, we definitely need to study Black history, right? That's something I study. Mm-hmm. I really kind of entered Black studies via literature. So I was an undergrad at South Central University for Nationalities in Wuhan. And then I did a master's at Beijing Foreign Studies University. So I was able to study African American literature at those universities in China.
Mm-hmm. That's part of the general English literature major, right?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when I came to the US, I thought it would be more difficult for me to study literature because I'm not really any, like, I mean, I speak English, but English is not my mother tongue. So it's always difficult for me to read, you know, it's more difficult for me to read literature in English, and also more difficult for me to understand literary theory, mm. right? So I wanted to do history. But now I realize that what I do is not that different from literary studies. So,
it's not.
Yeah, because my work has become more and more theoretical, yeah. and I'm also doing a lot of literary stuff. So it's interesting that I'm really coming back to literature, but still Africana studies is like that. It is not, you can say Africana studies is an interdiscipline, right? It is a kind of a congregation of different fields traditionally defined, but still Africana studies is characterized by this kind of intimacy of various fields, right? So we use whatever frameworks, whatever fields that might help us to better understand like a phenomenon that we study.
Mm, that's really interesting because, well, in studying history and studying literature in China, we grow up knowing this kind of, this is something that my teacher at least tell me all the time, is that 历史也是人写的故事, like history is a form of literature that is written by human beings, or written by, say, the winners, or written by the a certain class. You know, we yes. have historiography that, like Han Shu, dating back to like 2,000 years ago, when people started writing on paper or writing on bamboos to preserve them. So yeah, 文史不分家 is always the saying, like you can't separate literature from history. And both fields are really, really exciting. And I feel like when you were talking about you studying, African studies in China, it's a bit like, and then coming to US, it's a bit similar to what Claudia Jones might have felt a little bit, your research study, your academic hero, Claudia mm-hmm. Jones felt when she was a Black feminist leader in the Communist Party USA, and when she visited China back in the 60s, right, when it was still communist China. I don't know whether she met with Chairman Mao or met with any of the leaders back then, but it is like very interdisciplinary and very international exchange. So that's really, really interesting. Can you tell us more about like who Claudia Jones is? Like we don't know that much about her. We know, you know, the Black Panther, we know, you know, the civil rights movement, Martin Luther King and all that, but and as I know from reading a little bit about her, her main like rights movement focus was on creating an anti-imperialist coalition managed mm-hmm. by working class leadership, fueled by the involvement of women. Can you tell us more on that, and what if she visited China, and if she left us any literature or scholarship?
Sure, and thank you so much for the question. So as we know, March 8th, International Women's Day is approaching, right? And it's really important to talk about Claudia Jones really in the context of the International Women's Day, right? So a lot of people actually don't know the origins of the International Women's Day, right? So the International Women's Day was actually like this idea was proposed by a socialist feminist. Her name is Clara Zetkin, right? And Clara Zetkin really wanted to develop, this idea of International Women's Day. And Clara Zetkin did a very important book, which Claudia Jones read. And that book is, The Surplus Woman, right? So that book is about socialist feminism, right? Mm-hmm. And Claudia Jones herself.
When was it published?
Yes. So the book, this is a correction. So the book is entitled Lenin on the Woman Question, right? It was published, I think, in the 1930s. I might be wrong. But Claudia Jones read Clara Zetkin, right? And who was Claudia Jones? So Claudia Jones was an Afro-Trinidadian activist. So she was born in Port of Spain, Trinidad. At the time, Trinidad was still a British colony, right? And she migrated to the US at the age of 8. And she grew up in Harlem. And she really became involved in a lot of civil rights struggles in Harlem during the interwar era, right? And I think just to talk about just to mention a little bit about the background of Claudia Jones's upbringing. So in the interwar period, the Communist Party USA played an important role, if not the leading role, in civil rights activism, right? So Claudia Jones was impressed by what the Communist Party USA did. And she was particularly impressed with the CPUSA's efforts to defend the Scottsboro Boys. The case of the Scottsboro Boys was about a group of Black boys who was sentenced to death because they supposedly raped a white woman. And later it turned out they actually didn't do that. And Claudia Jones was very impressed with the efforts on the part of the Communist Party to defend these young Black men.
Mm-hmm.
So Claudia Jones, joined the Communist Party and became a leading theoretician of the concerns of issues of Black working class women, right? So here we still need to talk about International Women's Day. So in, I think it was in 1951, Claudia Jones gave a speech on the International Women's Day, which was also in the context of the Korean War. So Claudia Jones,
it was the 50s, right? I guess.
Right, yeah. So Claudia Jones made that speech against the Korean War, against American involvement in the Korean War on the International Women's Day. And that speech actually became the major evidence for her later imprisonment and deportation.
Oh, she was deported back to the UK, or?
So she was deported to the UK. So as we know, Claudia Jones was a member of the Communist Party, and the early Cold War in the US was also marked by this kind of McCarthyist anti-communist hysteria, right? So so the thing is, in the 1950s, you didn't really have to be a communist to be called a communist, right? You didn't have to be communist as long as you really sought civil rights reform. As long as you were agitating for social change, all the conservative forces could always paint you as a communist. So, but Claudia Jones herself was a communist. So she was imprisoned because of a communist conviction, and she was deported to the UK. So the reason why she wasn't deported to her hometown in Trinidad was that the British government didn't want her to be back in the colony because they were afraid that she might cause trouble, quote unquote trouble, because she herself was a great political activist. So the British government was afraid that she might, you know, help with the decolonization movement in Trinidad, right? So she was deported to the UK, and when she got to the UK, she did not stop her activism. So she decided to work with the Afro-Caribbean communities in London, right? So there's another history about people in the UK, right? So there had always been Black people in the UK for sure, but there was a wave of migrants after the end of the Second World War from the Caribbean to the UK, right? So around that time, there was a labor shortage, and those people in the UK were called the Windrush generation. The Windrush, Windrush is the name of a ship, right? And so it was one of those ships that transported laborers from the Caribbean to the UK. And Claudia Jones worked with those people in the UK, and she created a newspaper called the Caribbean Gazette and Afro, the West Indian Gazette and Caribbean Afro-Asian News, right? So, and it was really like when she was in the UK that she developed a understanding of China, right? So she went to China in 1964. So she was in China for, I think, 7 weeks, and she did meet Mao Zedong, and she also met Sun Qingling. Yes, and so the thing is, she died right not long after she came back from China, so we still didn't really know much about her trip, but she did, she did write a little bit about her trip in China in her newspaper, the West Indian Gazette. If you want to know more about this, you can go online, go to YouTube. So I actually gave a talk a few weeks ago, virtually at the University of Toronto, and I talked about Claudia Jones's activities in China in the context of the Sino-Soviet split and the Cold War. And so there's definitely more information there.
That's really cool. I will definitely attach that onto the podcast piece later. So Claudia Jones was in China, and actually as a civil rights leader, or as a Communist Party leader. What was China like back then with, you know, Black leaders? Because this is rarely known until, you know, in the past few years when China and and Africa and countries had more and more economic exchanges, right? And then there are more African students going to Guangzhou, particularly to study. So there's a growing African population in China right now. So people start to, like, the population start to understand more and want to know more about, you know, when were they here? The communists, and they're communists, and they're also anti-colonial, and they're also Black people back in 20th century. Were there many of them? And I know that the Black Panther also had, did they visit China as well? Like, what was it like back then with the whole, like, environment, atmosphere? And were they, like, really well welcomed, or are they, like, seen as kind of alienated or something like that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. So in the 1960s, right? So China wanted to reach out to the third world, and we need to understand that in the context of the China-Soviet split, right? So as we know, in the 1950s, China was allied with the Soviet Union. And in 1959, the China-Soviet split became public, right? And China needed support from the third world. So there, this is really a very complicated history of, Sino-Soviet competition for the third world, and how China really wanted to engage the third world in the context of the Cold War in the Sino-Soviet split. So, I'm just really creating a simplistic version of that history. So Mao was supportive of anti-imperialist struggles globally, mm-hmm. right? And Mao was definitely supportive of the Black freedom struggle in the US and also African decolonizing movements. So a lot of activists went to China, and including the Black Panther Party, right? Mm-hmm. And so the Black Panther Party actually made two trips to China. Oh. And I guess the first trip was led by Eldridge Cleaver, who was at the time in exile. Eldridge Cleaver was the leader of the international section of the Black Panther Party. Mm-hmm. And Eldridge Cleaver was involved in a shootout with the police in the US, and he didn't want to be in prison. So he fled out of the US. And then he did a tour in Asia. That tour included Vietnam and China, mm-hmm. and North Korea, maybe some other places. I don't remember exactly where they went. But so that was the first trip. And the second trip was led by Huey Newton, who was the Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party. Right, so Eldridge Cleaver went to China before Nixon's visit in 1972, before Henry Kissinger's visit, and then Huey Newton went to China after Henry Kissinger's visit and after the announcement of Nixon's visit in China. So Huey Newton wanted to beat Nixon. Because he wanted to be, to be able to visit China before Nixon did.
Yeah.
So So you have to really understand the kind of global reach of Maoism, right? So in China, we call Mao's ideas or the ideas of people, including Mao and, people in his generation, Mao Zedong Sisia, Mao Zedong Thought. But globally, we call Mao's ideas Maoism, right? So Maoism had great importance for activists in America and in France, right? So I think many people know about, the history of the 1968, right? So we know what happened in France. There were strikes, student movements, what happened in the US, right? So at Columbia, for example, there was a great student movement at Columbia that was also part of the kind of global uprising in 1968. Mm-hmm. And Maoism was-
at Columbia University or Columbia?
Columbia University.
Ah, cool.
Yeah, so Maoism was one of those ideas that animated that activism. Mm-hmm. So there are, recent works about global Maoism. Mm-hmm. And scholars have different perspectives really on Maoism, but there's one thing that they cannot deny, which is Maoism definitely had a global reach, right? It also reached Latin America.
The US, at least the US culture at the time.
Absolutely, yes. So, but still, we also have to understand that, you know, on the one hand, China did have a propaganda apparatus, like international propaganda apparatus, right? So so China did send messages, you know, news articles, op-eds, information globally, right, through Xinhua She, right? Many radical publications in the West paraphrased, translated, and circulated messages from China, or just articles from Renmin Ribao. Right. And on the other hand, we do have to know that those activists in the West, they also wanted to study Maoism, but that doesn't mean that they were trying to really serve China's geopolitical purposes, right? So they sometimes try to understand Maoism, but not really trying to work with China, right? And sometimes their understanding, actually in most cases, their understandings of Maoism were truncated, were not really, were actually limited, right? So they
might have a shallow understanding of it, just to impose it onto their own agenda, I guess.
Yeah, so for example, the Black Panther Party emphasized Mao's ideas about struggle, about guerrilla warfare, but they didn't focus as much on Mao's ideas about party building, about mobilization of the masses, right? About the objective conditions for revolution. So that's why really in reflecting on the 1960s, Frederick Jameson developed this idea of symbolic Maoism, right? So the Maoism that those activists in the West really tried to explore, and the Maoist struggles that those who were in the West tried to emulate, was not really the Maoism as it existed in China. Right, so we do have to understand how, you know, ideas are really remade, or in the context of the 1960s, were remade and reconfigured in the process of the transnational communication circulation.
That's really interesting. That's really cool. Thank you so much. So that's a lot of history to absorb. But are there any literature really interesting, be it like fiction or nonfiction or autobiographical, on the African American experience in China, or vice versa, or in general? I guess growing up in China, mostly Chinese are taught, and majority is Chinese literature on Lu Xun and all these canons of historical fiction or nonfiction, mostly written in Chinese, right? So we rarely read any fiction. I guess we read Things Fall Apart by the very famous Nigerian author Chinua Achebe. Sorry if I butcher his name, but we don't know much about that, and in Chinese literature we rarely kind of see African American or African characters, I think. And your research is in this area. Do you know more? Are there any books you would recommend us to read?
Sure. First of all, so this is also, I guess, a kind of self-promotion. So I helped write the book in Chinese, cool. Which is published by 中国社会科学出版社. So that book is entitled 从边缘走向中心美国黑人文化。So I did a chapter on literature. I think that's chapter 4. So that's basically a brief overview of African American, the history of African literature. And I just, provide some basic information on some authors and texts that are considered important in African-American literary studies. And there are actually, translations of African-American literature in China, right? So I think every novel of by Toni Morrison is available in China in Chinese.
Yeah.
Right. And I think recently, I think James Baldwin's novels were translated. You can also have access to Richard Wright's Native Song, I think. Ralph Ellison's The Invisible Man. I think you can, so some of the newer works, right, you can have access to Edward P. Jones's The Known World, right? So I actually wrote my first paper in Chinese in African American literature about Edward P. Jones's novel, The Known World, which is translated into Chinese as 已知的世界. It's about a black slave owner in the US, right? You can say it as a, well, it's not really a slave narrative, but it's about the history. It's about
the American South.
Fact of the history of slavery, right? Not people know about, slave owners who are black, right? I think you can also have access to some of the feminist works, for example, books by Alice Walker, right? Mm-hmm.
On the color purple.
Yeah, and I think that's translated. Mm-hmm. And also, I think Sarah Neale Hurston's The Eyes of Watching God, I think that's also translated.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can have access to those books in China.
That's
right.
That's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there a African studies department in any Chinese universities?
Yeah, so there is a an African studies center at Beida, Peking University, and also at Zhejiang Shifan Dashue, Zhejiang Normal University. I think it's so these institutions are their version of African studies is more about China-Africa relations. So their purpose to serve the Chinese government. So it's I'm not saying that's wrong, but that's just one version of African studies, right? It's like American studies in China. American studies in China is mostly about China-US relations. Whereas American studies in America is about race, gender, sexuality, American culture. So it's very different.
Speaking of that, I know that you're very up to date with the Sino-Africa relationship, which, right now it's quite different from in the 60s, the rights movement or the communist movement everywhere. Well, right now, China is arguably more capitalist than a lot of the very capitalist world countries. And we've been seeing a lot of cultural exchanges between China and African countries, economically, diplomatically, with the Belt and Road Initiative, and a lot of movies now have travels to Africa, and they're portrayed in all different ways, like in one very, very popular, I guess, movies, Zhanlang, the Wolf Warrior movie, which is very, nationalistic or patriotic, on the the Chinese soldiers in Africa, and they're defending like their our own people or the factory workers in Africa, Chinese factory workers, and all these, and we even see that there are African figures or portrayals of African people in China in the Chunwan, in the very like annual celebration of Spring Festival, which is here, which is the biggest event, a TV event, I guess, of the whole year. And that's, you know, had a lot of controversy with like blackface and all that. Can you tell us more on just in general, like what's the relationship like right now? What do you see is problematic, and what do you see is the good part of this relationship, and where do you see it going, kind of?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, China-Africa relations have become a very important topic. And there really have been a wide range of voices, right? So some people think China is recolonizing or colonizing Africa, mm-hmm. right? And some people are very positive about what might be called South-South exchanges, mm-hmm. right? So I guess my position is that China's not colonizing Africa. So whatever China is doing cannot be simply called colonialism, mm-hmm. right? You might be able to call it colonialism with Chinese characteristics, but still, you'd have to know that the kind of a colonialism that, quote unquote, colonialism that China is doing is different from the colonialism by the British, by the French, by the Germans, by the Belgians, right? So some scholars say, if you call whatever China is doing in Africa colonialism, you are actually kind of whitewashing Western colonialism in Africa, mm-hmm. right? But also, you can't just, you know, ignore some of the problems that have emerged really in China-African relations, right? So we could say, you know, many critical resources in Africa are being controlled by the Chinese, mm-hmm. and how China's involvement in Africa has led to corruption, and how China is controlling the economies of some African nations. So we do have to be really aware of that as well. For me, I think it's important to really, I think, to reimagine China-Africa relations, right? Beyond a kind of, so I wrote an essay about China-Africa, and mm-hmm. my argument is that China-Africa relations have to be reconfigured beyond the kind of international relations operative in the capitalist world, mm. right? We need to think about how China-Africa relations can be revolutionary, can, you know, help Africa develop self-determination, can help Africa retain its control of its critical resources, and can create, you know, horizontal relationships, right? So African and China, Chinese relations should not be a hierarchical relationship, right? It should not be, you know, China being on top and Africa being right below. Yeah. So we need to think about that. We do have to think about how we need to rethink that. And that's really just the one abstract argument I make. But what I'm excited about China-Africa relations is the kind of cultural exchanges that have been made possible, mm-hmm. right? So for example, China helped build a museum in Senegal, right? That museum really right now is one of the museums to have a kind of Pan-African vision of African culture, right? So one argument made by like those European museums that still have artifacts stolen from Africa is that Africa has no capacity to preserve those things. Well, now the Asian Museum, there are actually a few museums in Africa that can do that, right? So it's time for them to return those stolen objects. Mm-hmm. I'm excited about that. And I'm also excited about the fact that more and more people are reading and studying African literature in China. So mm-hmm. I think that's good because when you study, those great African thinkers, you can actually gain insights into the kind of China-African relationship that actually might be revolutionary.
That's really interesting. That's really cool. Do you think there is, I agree with you because when we're talking about capitalism and when we're talking about China-Africa relationship under the capitalism system, then there is always, going to be one that's exploiting the other party. So there is almost like a no way out in the the conversation or the dialogue about this subject. And with cultural exchanges, there is much less emphasis on like the gaining and the losing of rights or of things and more on just a win-win situation. Can you tell us a little bit more about what your idea or opinions are on the discussion of race in the China-Africa relation or the importance of talking about racial justice in China with African studies and in general, because there are more and more cultural exchanges, there are more Africans going to China for studying or for working and Chinese people have been for most of the history not that diverse. I guess the population is not that diverse. It's more of a homogenous population with Han Chinese majority, and we don't grow up seeing, all these countries, except in like newspaper and in like embassies, I guess. What do you think should it be like in say Chinese textbooks to talk about race, gender, identities, and all these things? Do you think that would be?
Sure. Yeah. So a friend of mine, Huang Kun, recently wrote a piece for Peng Pai in Chinese, and people mm-hmm. can read it. Mm-hmm. I think it's it's actually a very good piece. It's about really the how blackness as understood in China is also sexualized in China as well, mm-hmm. right? So I'm actually writing a piece about blackness in China. So that's more a review essay. So I'm just trying to kind of figure out some of the questions to ask. So one question that I want to ask, or one provocation that I want to make is really about how anti-blackness in China has been really shaped or inflected by different historical contexts, right? Mm-hmm. So there are scholars who worked really hard to show that China, the Chinese people, are just as racist as white people, which I think is is not a productive argument. So the what we need is not a comparison, right? We don't have to compare to say like who is more racist or they are just as racist as each other. What we need is anti-racism, mm-hmm. right? So many scholars have been able to demonstrate that there is a tradition of anti-blackness in China, right? Dating back to like ancient China.
Mm-hmm.
But that tradition really keeps changing, right? Because we do have to understand how blackness is understood in China in relation to, you know, economic development, right? China's position in the world and also Chinese conceptions of gender, class, and empire, right? Mm-hmm. So in the nationalist period, right, this dominant, I guess, understanding of blackness is about how blackness was also objection, right? So Hei Nu Yu Tian Lu, which is the Chinese translation of Uncle Tom's Cabin, mm-hmm. right? Was, I think, the first American text to be translated into Chinese. And that text was important to many people because that text showed that how imperialism and racism, like the kind of the effects of imperialism and racism in China, right? Mm-hmm. And Chinese nationalists, Chinese intellectuals at the time in nationalist China used the example of slavery to show that if people don't fight imperialism in China, the Chinese people would become slaves.
Mm.
Right? So, and then in Mao's China, so blackness is understood, was understood as revolutionary, right? So you could see all those representations of black activists in China, right? But also in China, according to Mao, the black freedom struggle in the US was part and parcel of the working class struggle, which was a position not very popular among a lot of African-American activists.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but now in a new liberal period, right, in a period marked by globalization, really the kind of global reach to capitalism, how do we understand blackness in China? That's something to think about, right? And I don't think scholars have been able to answer that question very well. And I'm trying to think about that in a new piece that I'm writing about and thinking about how blackness helped, to justify the kind of global inequalities that might have something to do with the Chinese capitalism. And I'm trying to understand how blackness in China, right? How those African migrants in China and their experiences might help us understand better really China's involvement in global trade.
That's really interesting. We've also been living in US for the past year during COVID, and there are waves of Black Lives Movement from George Floyd to toppling of statues in UK and Belgium, those with racist and colonial legacies. And a lot of Chinese people are debating racism, looking at US and looking at UK and these people protesting on the street, and they have all kinds of opinions. I don't know if you have anything like interesting that you have read or heard, like what are there streams of or strands of thoughts or opinions from those comments that people make, or are there like a more conservative or more liberal look? Or do you think that there's more just kind of a feeling of bystanding, like Kai Renau, kind of feeling in China?
So I actually also wrote a piece for Pengpai Xinwen.
Really, of course you did.
About the Black Lives Matter movement in the US.
Which is so, a great thing I'll share with my audience too.
Thank you very much. I would say, you know, some people are I guess indignant about, you know, like racial injustice in the US, but many people don't understand the kind of the root cause of the racism in the US and how racism is connected to, you know, other forms of injustice, including, you know, labor exploitation, sexism, heteropatriarchy, and other systems of oppression. But also, you know, the US government, like not just the US government, but also other, I guess mostly conservative Americans are angry that the Chinese government used the case of, you know, the killing of Breonna Taylor and George Floyd, you know, as examples to show like how terrible everything is in the US, right? They're like how China is qualified to really judge us, right? I would say in China, we haven't seen, you know, voices, like strong voices of support for Black Lives Matter movement in the US, whereas in like the UK or France, and there were like solidarity protests, right? But I would say it's nowadays in China, people are not as conversant as people in Mao's era with
like nationalistic or nationwide movements.
Yeah, with like, you know, like empire, imperialism, racism, right? So I guess it's a question of education, and it's also a question of a different context, right? It's a different context. So China is no longer interested in antagonizing the US. So we do have to understand, you know, the kind of larger geopolitical context in which, you know, all those movements about Black lives, where Black lives emerge.
You mentioned sexism and Black Lives Matter movement, and of course, Claudia Jones being a prominent Black feminist leader. What do you think is interesting, or what do you think is people should know about feminism, the feminism movement with Black movement? And specifically, I guess, if you could point to us some leading figures that we could go read about and know more about, would be great. And also, well, we were talking about how people no longer speak of feminism movement as in the first wave feminism, second wave feminism, because the ones that we know in growing up, or I guess in US education or college education, are mostly like white elite women who were the feminists, the first wave feminists, and people like Simone de Beauvoir, you know, they are very much like upper class and very much not really talking about race and just talking about gender, men and women, you know, different like biological and all that. What do you think is feminism studies looking like right now in academia and outside of academia? And do you agree where it is going? And yeah, these are a lot of questions. You can pick what you want to answer, but What do you think is important or would be cool to incorporate into Black feminist study?
Oh yeah, definitely. So, you know, the very fact of the kind of, I guess, conjoining of feminist movements and anti-racist movements really shows that Black feminism is about, it's not a one-dimensional struggle, right? It's not just about women's issues. It's about, you know, how different systems of oppression, including racism, sexism, right, homophobia, class exploitation, ableism, imperialism, really overlap and intersect, right? So this is really the idea of intersectionality, right? So intersectionality is a major contribution of Black feminism to feminism in general, right? And the reason why we don't use, you know, this idea of a wave, the metaphor of waves to talk about feminism is that we talk about the first and second wave, we focus on white women's activism, right? And if you think only in the second wave, like women were able to talk about intersections of race, gender, and class, then you'll be wrong, because people like Claudia Jones talk about the same thing in the 1940s, right? And Black women have been able to talk about, you know, the struggle, struggles that really fought both racism and sexism, really like, even like in slavery, right? So that's how, that's why we no longer use like the metaphors of waves. There are really many great Black feminist thinkers to read. I would encourage people like to read people like Angela Davis, Claudia Jones for sure, and definitely the statement by the Comma He Collective, and poets including Audre Lorde, June Jordan. You can also read definitely Toni Morrison. They all talked about, you know, similar issues in different ways for sure.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. That's a lot to think about for me and for my audience. And thank you as we approach the International Women's Day to have you share your thinking on these issues. Thank you so much. And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back here next year when you finish your thesis, and good luck on everything with school and with finding a career in academia or outside of academia on this subject.
And thank you very much.
I'll definitely attach your essays to share with my audience. Great. See
you. Thank you.